Yo, what up? It's DK. Thank you so much for listening to the Mixing Music Podcast. I just want to do a quick plug about Antares and Auto-Tune. Antares makes the original industry standard Auto-Tune that we all know and love the sound of. We are sponsored by them, so if you visit mixingmusicpodcast.com/Auto-Tune, we do get a small kickback from every purchase. Thank you so much for supporting the show. Please enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host, DK, and with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, Lazy Eye Lou.
Whoa. Hey, we got that fixed. Now that I'm wearing my glasses again, we got that fixed, okay? Okay? I wasn't looking at the sandwich and at my wife at the same time, okay?
There is... You don't actually have a lazy eye. We were just talking about glasses and the American eyewear... being a deep hole, rabbit hole of corruption. That's all it is. And every time I go to Japan, I get like a few pairs of glasses because getting your vision checked by an optometrist for glasses, for the sake of glasses. So just getting vision checks, that's a minimum wage job in Japan. Like the machines are so, so well and so easy to learn that you don't need to renew a prescription every year.
I think my favorite thing about like an eye exam is how simplistic it is, that it's done in less than 5 minutes. But part of the issue is like you just walk up. They're like, OK, sit down, look into this thing, stare at the Christmas tree. OK, we're done.
Yeah, it's literally just it's so easy to do. And then also if you're like, hey, I like my prescription, I just want new glasses, they can scan the lens. They'll scan the lens and you don't need to get a new prescription. In fact, like having a prescription is like completely unnecessary. And on top of that, glasses are significantly cheaper. And I would not argue that Japanese people have more, like there's more demand for glasses. That is not the case. There's significantly higher population in general in America. And so even if only half the people needed glasses compared to Japanese people on average, it would still be about the same, like as far as the industry goes. But don't look into it. It's just corruption. It'll just make you pessimistic about government and capitalism. And when they collaborate on things, it just kind of... Anyway, won't get into it. Today's episode is, so you want to start a studio. Wow, you have the balls to want to start a studio, huh? Well, that's good.
Big and juicy ones. Hey, it takes balls. Let's be honest. It's a creative industry. It's
describing balls as juicy is just like, that is how you make babies. I don't know. Like, that just sounds wild. It's a wild way. Anyway, I keep thinking about that. All right, we're going to stop. Anyway, we're going to get into this episode about, so you want to start a studio, things you want to consider. Lou and I have started a couple studios, one independent from each other and one together. And we haven't actually made the official announcement yet, but since January of this year, so of 2024, we actually closed down the studio. And we could talk about that, why, and why it's good, good news for us, and why you may want to leave. That could be at the end of the studio, why having a studio may not be for you. And I think that'll actually be a good conversation as well. But let's first start off about building a studio, having a studio, and why that may be good for you. So let's start off. You want to start a studio. First off, that's wild. You must have some experience. I don't know about you, Lou, but when I started my first studio, I had like almost no experience in studios.
So when I first started mine, I like to think that I had experience as an engineer working, but I'd never actually had like any kind of business experience. I never actually understood what it meant to like maintain your overhead. And for me, it was just like, okay, how much is this going to cost me per month and can I afford it? You know,
so very short-sighted.
And I had a production team I came in with.
Yeah. I don't remember thinking too deeply about the long term either. I mean, the part of the brain, the frontal cerebral cortex, whatever. I have no idea what the fuck I'm talking about. All right. But I have heard from Huberman that the part of the brain that can weigh the benefits of the future that can actually think with foresight, mm-hmm. like getting educated now will increase my chances in the future. That part of the brain doesn't fully develop until you're about like 25 and a slightly younger for women. But I don't remember. Maybe that's the reason why. Maybe I was just a dumbass. I don't know why, but I don't remember thinking beyond like a couple months in the future. I just really wanted to do it. I was really naive. I don't think I had the proper experience as an engineer. I had some experience. I knew how to use Pro Tools a little bit.
I feel like that's every entry position though. So
yeah,
we'll give you credit there.
So, but here's the thing. I like with that like intern level knowledge, I started a studio and yeah. I was the head engineer and the owner of the studio. And that, in retrospect, was probably one of the dumbest things, but it worked out in my favor because I had the work ethic to back it up. But, Lou, it sounds like you were in a relatively similar boat. It sounds like you had a little bit more experience than I did when you first started your studio, which was in L.A., by the way, right?
Yeah. So not too far from where we had in the mix, like less than 10 minutes from there. It was actually pretty much up the street on Linkersham.
Nice. Yeah. So it was really close.
Yeah, it was really close. But I also had a production team that I was working with. So I was working with a group called MeFly. And, you know, that consisted of a couple different members. You've heard me bring up Goldie in the past. And funny enough, what was helping on the opening the studio side was that I was working at Sam Ash. And so aside from actually like engineering, I was actually networking and meeting a lot of people that I was learning from along the way. And so that gave me just a little more experience. I had already been working with some of the clients at their own studios and at other like facilities in the area. And so I already had experience of like what to expect that when opening a studio, what are clients looking for? What are the reasons they're booking them? Why are they excited to go to one location versus a different location? And that kind of helped feed, I guess, some of the starting points of opening that studio. But I definitely would say, looking back, I didn't know shit. It was really just shooting at the wall and seeing what hit, you know?
Yeah, throwing spaghetti on the wall, seeing what sticks.
Yeah, I don't want it to stick. I don't want to clean it up later. I'd rather there be a hole. I could plaster it. You know, I'll shoot the wall and see what hits. It's just an easier cleanup process.
You make me sound good at idioms, dude. You make me...
What is it? Don't make it... Like, don't make a mountain out of a molehole.
Yeah, don't make a mountain out of a molehole, dude.
Yeah.
Moles make holes. They don't make hills, dude. They make holes. I don't know why. And it rhymes. I don't know why that's not the same. Mole anyway, hole. No sweat off my ass.
Yeah, that's another one.
Anyway, where did we... Context. I'm very... The only part where like English as a second language really comes out for me is American idioms. I can never get them right. And Lou seems to be the same way.
Well, I am also English second language, but on my end, I think the funnest one that I ever realized didn't come till later in life. I've never had to say iron. Like, I knew iron as a metal, but in Spanish, to iron your clothing is to plancharlo. You know, so estás planchando tu ropa. You are ironing your clothing. But I've never actually said iron to anyone in my life before, like a couple years ago, and I was like, fuck, how do you say plancha in English? And I'm sitting there like, do I really not know how to say a fucking iron? What kind of person am I that doesn't know how to say iron?
A foreigner. That's what
I'm a guy.
A gaijin, dude.
See, this anyway. Is what happens with you first gen Americans.
Anyway, so you want to start a studio, let's get into it. Some reasons that you may have, you know, you feel like you have to. I don't know why, but a lot of people getting into engineering, you just feel like you have to.
Yeah.
And to a certain degree, depending on where you're at, that may not be far from the truth. Like in LA, you definitely don't have to. If there are big studios around you, you definitely don't have to. And here's the thing, we have to kind of generalize this advice for like the person, for like Linhart that's listening, that's like 15 minutes away from the Amish, you know, living like in the middle of nowhere. And then also for like a dude named Joseph that like lives in West Hollywood. So it's like it's totally different. So we're going to have to generalize here, but depending on your area, you may want to start a studio. you may not have to if there's a lot of, like, if you're living in LA or in Nashville where there's a lot of studios, you don't have to start a studio. There shouldn't be a pressure to. You may want to build your own home studio, but to invite clients to, you don't necessarily need to build it for that. It's more for, yeah, like, taking work home, working on things at home. If you need to take a mix home, like, having enough that you can actually just use some plugins at home, right? Having a working, yeah, computer, maybe some cheap monitors, doesn't matter. And then there's levels of home studio where Lou and I do it, where it's like, it's full on commercial grade studio, but inside the home,
yeah,
where that's a whole different case. 100% of our work is at home. Right. So it's a totally different paths. But first off, the question that I think you need to ask is, having a studio, owning a studio is completely different from engineering. And if you are in a place where there's not many studios, like my first studio was in Utah. There were a few studios around, but it was very normal for the head engineer to also be the owner. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a full-on business. It was a one-stop shop. You come in for producing, for recording, probably some mixing, whatever. And that was the marketplace was so small that the demands of the local demographic was they'd rather hire one person from beginning to end. Where in LA, there's so much demand for studios and mixers and stuff, they probably go to a different producer and a different songwriter and a different studio every time. And then they hire their one go-to mix engineer, probably. And then the label takes care of the mastering with whoever they trust, right? So it's like, it's all over the place. It's going to be a different studio every single time because there's so many offerings. And so they're probably going to be picked off of, like, and all the studios are so busy that it's like, we need to just find a studio that's open last minute. Like, that's a pretty common thing. So the demand is totally different. So that's something to consider. So you want to start a studio. Just to be clear, Lou and I are on the same page that owning a studio is very different from being an engineer at one. Lou, I know that you don't have as much small town. You don't have any small town studio business. But yeah, I mean, even you can kind of guess on how it's different. Yeah. What do you think I mean by that?
So, I mean, realistically, consider this. If you're trying to build a brand as an engineer and you think opening a studio is going to help you that, even as a producer, in LA, you can go anywhere. There's studios that are cheap and they just work just to get work done. And there's studios that are really high for, you know, high flyers. You know, they've got a $2,000-$3,000 per 12-hour price tag, you know. And if you're trying to impress somebody, then you can go there. But it's not really that necessary to do it in your home and have all your clients showing up into your own home, seeing your space, knowing where you live, being able to knock on your door at all times. So that's not really something that's necessary. But if you're in a smaller town, let's say that there's no way that people are going to believe you're an actual recording engineer because you work from home, then yeah, I understand the need to have like an actual spot, a commercial space. It's part of your
branding. What about skills? What about skills?
Like, aren't skills as necessary in a smaller town than it is in a bigger town.
No, I mean like the skills between an engineer and a business owner, like in a studio owner.
You definitely need business savvy and you need to have the ability to delegate. If you can't learn to delegate, it's not going to work out for you at all. I think that was the biggest hurdle for me.
What about, I mean, even in LA, there is a benefit to owning a studio as an engineer, right? Like, I mean, you did it twice, even in LA. Like, I will say there is a vibe difference and maybe even some professional difference between a head engineer that owns their studio or at least has a home that doesn't have. And then there's the studio that's like the last minute on call, wherever you need me to be type engineer. And maybe you have a better grasp on this, but like, what are the benefits of owning a studio even in LA?
I'll say it like this. I think that if you're the head engineer and owning the studio, you're big dog and they're always going to put the studio expecting to see you, which means the more you work, the more your studio succeeds. But when you're just acting as the owner, you can actually have an entire community working alongside you. Even people that don't spend every day there, you know, you have people that you have in your phone book that you can call for a session, for a production, for a mix, this and that. And the studio succeeds as long as your community succeeds. You don't have to be the one done putting in every hour of every session's worth amount of work. And the power of that, the benefit as an owner, is that you actually have the ability to network and be the person in charge to the people who are booking your studio without actually having to spend all the time in the studio. You actually get this kind of given persona of, let's just call it, the big dog in the studio. That's the owner. That's the guy that owns this place.
So
this,
like,
is
some
his
PR
amazing
benefit.
Space. There's a PR benefit to being the owner. But professionally speaking, how come you're not the one engineering? I've actually been asked in the past that in the mix where they're like, so you don't engineer the sessions yourself, do you? I'm like, no, I do once in a while. I'm just very selective of who I work with. And that
and
was the
clear.
Turnaround of that.
That doesn't make sense. I mean, like, in LA, it's just so busy that if you do it right, you'll get so many bookings that it's just not feasible to engineer every session.
Yeah, it's
right?
really not.
Where, like, if you're in a small town, that may be, like, the weirdest thing. Like, why wouldn't you engineer every session? It's because sometimes it does get that busy. And it's also, like, more scalable. If you can have somebody that are willing to do the late night sessions that start at 8 p.m., so you can go home, but the studio can keep making money at night, like, that,
why wouldn't you?
Yeah, why wouldn't you? And you kind of need to do that in order to make a, like, to do well in LA. Like, you can't just work 40 hours a week and open a studio and pay yourself. Like, it's the overhead's way too high. And that's something to consider. With every small business, almost always the reason why they close down, and most small businesses do close down quickly within the first 5 years, statistically speaking, I don't have the stats in front of me, but it's over half. They do close down within the first 5 years, mostly because it's a lot of overhead, managing overhead. And I do think a good piece of advice that my dad gives, like always, is you, and this is beyond business too, this also goes into personal life, you always want to keep your overhead as low as fucking possible. And that means, yes, you can afford a nicer apartment, but if you're comfortable with an apartment that's, you know, two-thirds of the cost, a third of the cost, a half the cost, do it. You know, I think the biggest lesson that my dad ever gave me is that he was on a single income, was cleared to, like, I'm not going to try to give away too much. He was cleared to buy a home and take on a mortgage that was about 7 times more than he bought the house for. So, like, he bought his last house for almost, you know, 10 to 15% of what he was cleared for. And I think that speaks volumes on his money management, right? And I think that that's something that we should think about. In LA, it's really tough. Like, we had 2 rooms, and that was $5,000 for 2 rooms. And so, which is a lot. Like, in Utah, I had 2.5 rooms, like almost 3 rooms, and I paid the $900, and it was in my own building. Yep. It was in my own standalone building. So granted, it looked like a meth house from the outside, but these are things that you have to consider. Like, overhead is insane, and these things will eat you alive, and you're going to have one slow month. And if you can't handle one slow month and you're just, like, screwed from that point, that's something you need to consider. Like, I don't want to, like, jinx anybody, but it is fairly normal for all of us that it's not like some salary job, like owning a studio, getting paid when you work. Like, you're going to have slow months, whether it's in December, whether it's in, like, March, it doesn't matter. You're going to have slow months. And if you can't put food on the table during those slow months, your overhead is killing you. Your overhead is killing you. You also need to learn how to save money. Money management is a huge skill you're going to need to have regardless of whether you become a studio owner or not, but it's going to become more important when you become a studio owner. You need to have that ability to, like, save for rainy days, because those rainy days do come, or those dry seasons do come. Those dry spells do come. You got to be careful for that. You need to figure out how to business savvy is in, like, understanding your demographic. Who is your client? Who are you trying to market to? Marketing is important, but a lot of it is super basic. And these are things, okay, write this down if you want to, but these are super basic things to help you promote your business in a location-bound setting. So, like, it is not scalable by location. A cool thing about an online mixing service is that it is scalable by location. You could be anywhere in the world. But if for the recording studio, you only have, like, something that I think about is, like, what is it called? Like the radius of interest. Like how many hours is your average client willing? How many minutes are they willing to drive to come to your location? Like yep. Disney World has a wider radius of influence because people are willing to come from different countries, you know, yep. And Six Flags has a smaller radius of influence where like people are willing to drive 3 hours for Six Flags, but not for, they're willing to drive more for, but with the studio, like what is it? An hour, 2 hours, maybe 30 minutes? I don't know. It depends on your competition.
I've kind of found that, like, for studios, especially in our case, like, when it came to locations, like, we were in a pretty prime location, North Hollywood. I would say that if you're in L.A. County, as the whole county, not just city limits, but if you were in Santa Monica, North Hollywood, downtown L.A., and West Hollywood-ish. West Hollywood has a lot of great studios, but they're very, very historic studios. I wouldn't say that there's any like big, booming, smaller end studios. But those four locations were kind of like the best ones to go to. But I noticed that people from West Hollywood would drag their feet about wanting to book studio time in North Hollywood because of LA traffic. It's not that it's that far. We're talking about a 10-mile drive. In any other state, that's 10 minutes. But in LA, that's a 40-minute drive.
Especially because there's so much competition. Like, there's so many studios. Exactly. They could literally
go there. They're right down the street from you. So, if you're in Santa Monica,
30 minutes? Why would you drive 30 minutes?
Yeah. Exactly. In Santa Monica, there's a ton of great studios. In West Hollywood, there's a ton of great studios. North Hollywood, downtown LA. And the funny thing is, each one has a different price bracket for each option. So, if you were to go to the one in Santa Monica, you're probably paying a higher price because Santa Monica is just a nicer area. The rent for locations there is a lot higher, so they're probably going to have some higher costs to booking it just to keep their overhead in place. But if you go to downtown LA, where you could rent a studio for roughly $1,000 a month, you know, those bookings might be cheaper because the rent is cheaper. Yeah, yeah. So, but then so again, who wants to be in downtown LA at night?
Yeah, that's also scary.
Yeah.
But anyway, these are things to consider, things to think about. You need to do simple things. Like if you've done a basic entrepreneurship or business class in college, which, by the way, that's like one of the best classes you could take. If you are in college and you need to take an like you're in a music program, you need to take a couple electives, make sure they're economics and business. That's mm-hmm. That will help you so much. Because at the end of the day, here's the thing. If you want to start a business, even if you don't want to start a studio, if you want to just be an engineer freelance, you have to understand how taxes work. You need to understand business expenses, managing money. You need to understand marketing. You need to understand so many things. Yeah, Lou talked about delegating and management in general. You need to understand, like, and if you're owning a studio, then you need to start understanding about like demographics, avatars, and promotion and, client psychology to a certain degree and things of that nature. And all of these things, there's only two ways to learn. It's one is experience and just like two, thinking about, like just being told. For example, these are very simple, practical tips to put your studio on the map. And I don't know why people don't do this stuff. Number one, you open a studio. The first thing you should do is open a Google Maps business. Open a business on Yelp. You're going to get calls, block them. I don't care. Open a business, make sure that it's on Apple Maps as well. Like, just make sure you're on Maps. Put a Facebook business page up. You know, open an Instagram. Build a website that actually looks professional, that, like, looks good. These are all time-based things, like, very little skill-based things and mostly time-based things. Because you got to get, like, if you open a business studio or a business on Google, you have to get like, they have to send you a letter and then you have to verify that you're actually at that location. Same thing with Yelp, you know, things like, these are all just time-based things. Wix, if you build a website, it's all drag and drop type stuff and they have templates and they will walk you through SEO stuff. Posting on your social media, posting on TikTok or whatever. TikTok is not going to be, I don't know. We'll find out. These things are things to test. And then even better, how do you get more viewings and listings or upgraded listing on Google? Like how do you rise your studio to the top when someone types a recording studio? How do you get to the top? A lot of SEO, like putting in pictures, putting in videos, collecting reviews from friends, Having a proper written out description, like actually filling the profile all the way out, will put you at the top of the listings. Yeah, every time when I open a business or whatever, you go and text friends and be like, hey, dude, can you leave a 5-star? If we've ever worked together and you've had a good time, can you leave a 5-star review? The more reviews you get, the more Google. There's the podcast. This podcast blew up and we were number one podcast in 3 categories in 2019 with skyrocketed. Our podcast, we're about to hit 1 million downloads. And that happened because we got reviews. And also the name of the podcast, Mixing Music. If you type in anything about music production or mixing or something like that, this is the first podcast that pops up. That's not an accident. We don't have this many downloads because we're the best. Although,
whatever. Hey, thank you. Speak for yourself, man. Yeah. Speak for yourself.
We do it because we're first. And that's valid. These are things that you need to think about. Here's another idea. Let's put up, and this takes a creative mind. The good thing is you're already creative. You wouldn't be doing music if you weren't creative. Here's the thing. This is how I sold out 6 out of 7 of my live shows when I was in a college band. Okay? Every time we did a show, we would market it as a dance party. Because why do people want to go to shows? Because they know other people will be there. College students want to go places where other people will be there, that they can have a good time. And if you call it, come see my band, it sounds like a fucking lonely jerk-off party. That's what it is. Like, what are you going to do? Jerk each other off on stage? No, this is going to be a dance party. And just changing that, immediately the vibe changed. We sold out almost every single show, minus one, where we didn't open. So, and like, whatever. That's a whole story. Excuses. But it's literally small things like that. When you understand, the reason why you understand your audience is what you do with that information. Okay. So another thing too, this is something that Brian Hood always talked about on the Six Figure Home Studio, was what makes your studio different from the one down the street. And if you have to, and if the only reason that makes you different is price, then you're fucked. That's it. If the only reason why people are coming to you is based on price, you're fucked. Lou, how do you motivate clients when the difference maker is price? How do you win them over?
You don't, but you can win them over at the same price. Just offer.
Hold on. I'm sorry. I'm asking you a leading question. So I'm trying to get an answer out of you. Sure. When price is the only thing that you're competing on, what is the inevitable thing that's going
to
happen?
Oh, you're both racing to the bottom. So at a certain point, you're just not going to be able to make money. Best case scenario, you're going to break even.
Yeah.
Best case scenario, you're making
less and
less.
You're competing on making less money. Yeah. That's how it is. You're lower dollar per hour until one of you is like, I can't do it anymore. You know, it's just not worth it. Yeah. Even if you have something like, I'm a sneakerhead and I have sneakers in this studio, that changes the vibe. That differentiates you from the next studio over, right? I speak Spanish. Lou speaks Spanish and works on hip hop is a great differentiator, right? DK is crazy and will talk your ear off, but is also really good at in-studio therapy sessions. Like, he'll make you feel like you're welcomed. I don't know. That's a big difference.
In session with Dr. D?
Yeah, usually when the engineer is the owner or when you're really tight with the engineer, the branding is a lot more personal. Like, DK gets shit done. DK is easy to talk to. DK is a cool vibe. And this is why we're always promoting talking about, like, people skills, right? Even something that's like, yes, it could be price, but it's also they're able to record drums at this studio. And that's not even possible at this other studio. This person specializes in metal. I mean, the low hanging fruit is genres and different offerings. The other one is the more higher IQ things is this guy actually responds to emails. This guy has a system in which you go on their website, you can check out a slot and pay for that time slot directly on the website without having to talk to anybody. Yep. Because they've removed so much friction between customer and provider that all I have to do is go on their website. It works. He's going to be there. I don't have to think about it. I don't even have to call in. Because if I have to call in and they have to get a quote and then it has to go through three different people, you're not going to get booked versus the dude that has no friction. You can just book online right there.
Yeah.
These are all things like, oh, you only accept Venmo? These are all things that you got to remove friction. And this takes some experience because you don't know what is causing friction, but you have to be thinking from customer experience, which is going to be number one as well. Okay, sorry, I'm like ranting. Lou, what fill the holes that I'm missing, the gaps. Connect some thoughts for me. All right, cool. What else am I thinking about?
Let's put it this way. Like, You also have to ask yourself, what is your level of consistency when opening a studio? And what I mean by that is, are you still working a 9-to-5 to keep it afloat at first? So how much attention can you honestly pay to it? One of the challenges of running a studio is being able to pick up every call that you get and actually be the salesman at the same time as the receptionist. If you got to field some questions for tech support, or do you have the time available for it? Or do you have people that you're going to have to pay for that, which is increasing your overhead? Is this something where if there's an overnight session, is somebody going to stay on site to make sure that they're taken care of? Or are you going to be at home 20 miles away, however far you are, and having to drive back for every time that there's a concern? If there's no lobby or something, let's say you're in a multi-room facility, are you just sitting in the hallway waiting for a question to come in? You know, you kind of have to look at the logistics of, like, what is the intention behind opening this studio? Like, what is the actual goal? Like, if the goal is for you to have a studio to work with your clients and just you don't have any intention of letting people book without booking you, then that may be less of an issue. But if you're looking to run it commercially and actually try to operate it as a business that can scale, then these are questions that a lot of people don't ask right away. It's like, some people would like a lobby because they like the aesthetic of a lobby, but they forget the utility of a lobby when it comes to having staff members that stay on site as support crew for sessions. And the cost that goes into that as well is going back into your overhead, you know?
You have to be thinking about this. And some of these things you don't come across until you start a business. So
yeah,
I do, this is hard to say, but I do encourage just going for it. Even if you fuck up, like, the amount of money that people pay to learn the lessons from somebody just simply fucking up. Like, even if you lose a little bit of money going into this business, people pay a lot of money and lose money for the education that it takes to get what you, the lessons that you learn firsthand and understand the reasons why. So it's like, I actually don't discourage people starting. Like, I think you should do it, even if you fuck up. I do think that fucking up is kind of within your control. And I think that it is a gamble, but you can, the difference between gambling is that gambling is totally random. And for this, you can make up a lot of the chance with work ethic.
You can actually kind of plan a certain amount of loss if you really plan it right.
Yeah. Like, so,
yeah.
Yeah, and then, but as far as, like, practical benefits go, depending on where you're at, again, if you're just looking to be an engineer and eventually want to be a mixer, maybe the studio's not the way to go. And here's the reason why, one of the reasons why it was bad for us, because at the end of I'm a mixer, right? I've always loved mixing. This has never changed. And when I was in Utah, I had a studio so I can mix. So I could invite clients to produce, to record, and then eventually I just switched to mixing. But, like, I had an office and I rented out the other rooms. Like, I used only one of the rooms and I rented out the other ones. I was just mixing. It was an office because I couldn't do it from home. And then all of a sudden, I move out here and I started owning a studio. It's different. Now, at the end of, like, we had the studio for like 3-4 years or whatever. And at the end of it, it was just like me managing a bunch of 20-year-olds. And that's not what I wanted to be doing.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get a Grammy by managing 20-year-olds.
Nope.
And I will say, like, it took separate time and separate effort that was not aligned with my goals. At the end of the day, having a record, because I'm just a mixer. I don't need a recording studio. I don't record or produce things, because a lot of mixers make up some income with some recording. I mean, Lou on the side does some live sound, you know, and does some recording and production or whatever. Like, yeah, it's very normal for engineers to do a little bit of other things on the side, but I only mix. Like, this is literally all I do. And other than the podcast and other small things, but, like, I don't need the full facility of a recording studio. So I'm not getting much out of it. And I'm getting, like, some PR and notoriety as the owner of this studio, which doesn't help me get more mixing gigs. If anything, it kind of became a negative thing, is because people were like, DK's too busy to mix for us. He's probably charging too much because he's making enough money from the studio. Like, it was kind of like this weird negative thing. And on top of that, we were making some money, sure. But I mean, it wasn't enough for me to be willing to give up my mixing career, which made me more than 80% of my income was from my mixing, because I would do it from home and there was, like, very little overhead. It was just straight income, straight profit. So it's just like, What are you going to do? So it's you have to balance these things out. At the end of the day, we closed down the studio. We had a lot of people be like, "Oh, I'm so sorry." Don't be.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because some people are like, oh my God, that sucks. I'm like, you know, in my current headspace, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think it was kind of therapeutic to let it go.
Yeah, like literally, I keep talking about it, like I'm not joking. Like it was not fun to be managing a bunch of 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
It was great to be respected by them. But like, how long does ego last for motivation? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, like when we first opened the studio, I would say that anything new and shiny, like a kid with a new toy, we're excited about it and we're going to play with it all day long. But when it came down to like the stress of it, I remember the first big moment of stress that I had that anybody ever witnessed was Henry. I was in the middle of a concert, and this is why I say like you're who you work with and your staff and how you agree to work is so important when planning a studio, because if you're just planning it as one person, you're like, oh, I don't think I'll need anybody just yet. Wait till you hear this. I was running a concert. I was literally doing monitor check with the band on front of the stage with the curtains open with the audience in front of me. I was getting a call for somebody trying to book studio time at that moment. They needed studio time now and they were ready to pay. And I also had somebody in our studio A with tech support issues, and I had nobody on site at the studio. And Henry was the only person at the concert with me trying to help me, but he was still in training. He didn't know what he was doing with the concert just yet. So I couldn't exactly tell him, hey, figure out their monitors. I need to take these calls. You know, I literally was trying to juggle three independent jobs while doing the primary one, but the other two were related to the same studio. One was incoming, the other one was fixing. And I, as one person, you're not going to be able to take that on. If you're working a 9-to-5 and running the studio at the same time, you need to plan for having another person working with you, whether that be a friend that you offer free studio time to or something. But, you know, you have to have some level of systems put into place as you go in. You know, you have to.
Yeah. And people don't think about this, but like automation mm-hmm. is important. Like in order, yeah. If you don't want to be paying a lot for employees and stuff, this like use the systems, like have auto-generated emails, use ChatGPT, whatever. Have a website that'll actually intake clients automatically. So you don't have to hire a phone manager that all she does, mm-hmm. all he or she does is stand by the phone and wait for people to call in, right? Let them book on their own. Let them qualify themselves. You know, you're going to have to learn things. You're going to have to get screwed over. Someone's, you know, so these are all things that are very important in order to do well and to make your life easier. And what better way to figure out what problems you need to figure out how to solve than to just create those problems like by starting a studio. So like I do recommend that.
Now it is pretty expensive to open one. If there was any kind of suggestion I would give, me and DK built our studio very quickly. In fact, from the moment we signed the paperwork to the day we actually took on our first session was less than 48 hours, only because me and DK already owned all of our own gear. I always enjoyed recording, especially with like bands and stuff as somebody who came up as a guitarist. But because of that, I already had like headphone amps that I liked, converters with enough inputs and outputs for drums and everything, enough preamps for all that kind of stuff. So when we walked in, we came in set. If you're walking in with just an Apollo, that's still doable. But once again, it's not necessarily something that's standing out. You're not standing out because of your gear. So you really have to stand out as an individual, and you have to have some level of client base already so that you just don't go under in the first few months, you know. But if you're planning on getting a space and then buying the gear or doing it all at the same time, you're walking into a huge cost.
That's actually a really good point.
You got to plan
for it. I don't know about you, but my first studio, taking over the lease also included me purchasing. Like, he wouldn't let me take over the lease of the building because he knew it was a good deal. He wouldn't let me take over the lease. And he put so much effort into remodeling the floors and the walls and stuff. And he was going to try to leave the music industry completely. So he said, you can take over the lease, but you have to buy my equipment. And so mm-hmm. I paid about $20,000, and I had to take out a loan for this. I took about $20,000, and then immediately paid back like $10,000 because I sold half of his equipment. I was working at Guitar Center at the time, so I had access to a lot of equipment. I'd been doing things from my house on a solo level for a few years. So I had enough equipment to get by. I didn't need all that stuff that he needed. And then I slowly bought more equipment over the years, right? And then by the time, like after 5 years of that, we both came together and had enough equipment to start studios here. So there's going to be a lot of people that don't have enough equipment or are thinking that they shouldn't start a studio because they don't have the right equipment. And these are very valid thoughts. And everybody's path is different. But I want to acknowledge that we both, in both situations, may have had some gear at the start. And yes, mine was at a risk. I can't speak on your story, Lou, but mine was at a risk. And again, my origin story is on paper, stupid. Like it was the dumbest business idea you could possibly have. But somehow we made it out. We worked it out.
Yeah.
And then I was going to say...
built clientele base, I think is
yeah,
big.
Slowly. I did everything that I talked about, like having Google Maps, having Yelp, reaching out to people, getting reviews, doing all the work, just looking busy, going to open mics, doing whatever I possibly can. I was in the habit of just to leave the doors open, leave the lights on, not making profits. I was in the habit of, and I had a business partner too, in the first little bit, the first year or two of that studio, which helped out a lot. We were doing like free sessions, so many free sessions just to get people into the door for, I had my own band. I was going to school full time in college. So like I was working like 80 hours in the studio, like 60 to 80 hours a week minimum in the studio that most of it was not compensated. Almost all of it wasn't compensated the first couple of years. And then on top of that, I was going to school full time. I was a full time studio, student. So, but I'm also a freak that runs 100-mile ultra marathons.
You freak.
So I just put it into perspective there. That's not like I'm not expecting you to be able to do the same. Now I'm gonna use that every once in a while. Like classic DK metaphor is gonna turn into I can't do this, but I can run a 100-mile marathon, but I'm not willing to do that. You know, like, that's gonna be a classic metaphor
it's like
from now
you,
on.
You go to some kind of interview and they're like, "So what would you say one of your strengths is?" It's like I'm a masochist and proud of it.
Yeah, although I wouldn't. That's a whole nother conversation. I wouldn't put ultra. I would put marathoners in the masochist category more than ultra marathoners. Actually,
no, I get it. We had this conversation, but and then an outside view, it's like, why the fuck would you run 100 miles?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Yeah, for reals. So, but the point is, I'm very driven, naturally very driven person, And I think that it does take someone like that at the end of the day to do well. I really do. But the cool thing is about being driven is that, yes, it might be a personality thing, but at the end of the day, it's consistent and consistent tough choices that are made. Honestly, that's all it is. It's knowing that this kind of sucks and it's annoying to do, but you consistently make the right choice. At the expense of personal comfort sometimes.
Yeah.
And hopefully eventually not at the expense of any comfort. It's going to be sacrificed, but these are all choices, which is if you are the driven type and you're just scared to put your foot down and just go for it, like don't be afraid, just go for it. Lou, any other thoughts? I'm trying to think about other things, any tips that we can give, why you might want to start a studio. Obviously, microphones, a snake if you have multiple rooms, if you're in a single room.
Oh, my God. The amount of cost on cables, I swear to God, I have a box. I counted up the value of one box of cables, of just my D-subs.
D-subs are expensive, though.
Yeah, I have $6,700 worth of D-subs in my back room right now.
Yeah, that's crazy. And you're not even using them, which is even more wild. And what are you going to do with cables? You can't like resell them, kind of.
You can. You actually find them at like 70 to 80% price tag of their new price. Yeah.
Cool. Well, especially if they're like Livewire or Mogami, because if you buy them used and they break, you could just take them to Guitar Center. They'll like swap them out for you.
Yep. And if you're in LA, it's Mogami's in the City of Commerce as their headquarters. So if they don't have it in store, you can go to the City of Commerce and go straight to the factory.
That's dope.
Yeah.
Okay. So another thing too is thinking about if you are starting a studio, the most important cost, we've talked a lot about this, so I'm going to reemphasize this. Having a good aesthetic and good acoustics is the most important thing.
Oh my God, I literally was talking about this yesterday.
If you're starting a studio, yes, you may have a bunch of like Audio-Technica mics. They're shitty mics. Who cares? That's significantly less important than taking the time to have decent acoustic acoustics. We're not talking about egg cartons. We're not talking about 1 to 2 inch foam panels that you can buy in bulk on Amazon. We're talking about proper acoustic insulation. You built them yourself or you bought them from GIK or something. You have tube traps. It doesn't matter. Okay. Get your shit right. And number two, take a trip to IKEA and make it look good. Repaint the walls. Get a bucket of paint and just repaint the walls if you need to. Go on Pinterest.
And a mop.
Yeah. Get a mop. Vacuum regularly. Get some rugs. Buy the rugs used. I don't fucking care. The point is, a trip to IKEA and Home Depot for some paint is going to make you more money in the long run. And that is the fact of the matter. And the fact that you have Audio Technicas is all not even secondary, it's tertiary. You have a Focusrite Scarlett 2i2, but it's in your own dedicated space where customers can park and come into, and it's not a residence. Already, like, having a private commercial facility already builds trust. And yes, even if you have a 2i2, you offer something that nobody else that has a home studio has, which is authority and privacy. You actually know what you're doing because you're paying extra to have this commercial facility. Yes. Like, just moving from residence to commercial increased my income, like, a little bit. Like, that, more importantly, increased my income because it immediately, for some wild reason, increased trust. People automatically started assuming that I knew what I was doing. And again, I told you before, I didn't quite know what I was doing when I first started.
It kind of goes back to like what I was saying about the whole big dog persona that the clients see you as is just the owner. It works for marketing. If you just say, oh, well, how come you don't record? Like you don't engineer? It's like, no, I'm just dedicated to mixing and mastering. It's like, oh, shit. Well, I'm looking for somebody to mix a song we're working on right now. Do you want to come in and listen? And there's kind of a different relationship that you build with your clients at that point. It's a really good networking opportunity. Let's just say that you already have the gear and you have a really nice home studio, but you're having a hard time wanting to book people from home, but you want to take on more sessions. That may be a reason to get a studio because you're finding your limitation is your home. You know, it's not that the limitation is clientele or gear. It's your comfort in your own home. You just don't want that many people knowing where you live, where they can find this gear. You may be a little bit protective because your family lives with you and you just don't want strangers in your house where your family is. That's totally understood. So one of the benefits is if you don't want to record every session, you can actually talk to a couple of engineers, just kind of make a little plan real quick and say, hey, I'm going to open a studio. I'm going to put this gear here. I just want to work with people who I trust at first. Once you open those doors, you'll notice all of their clients will now get to know you as the owner of the studio as well. You've just opened your network just by opening your doors to people.
Amen. Yeah. This is all things to think about. So again, kind of recapping all the practical things we've talked about. One, you need to determine if making the risky investment of opening a studio is right for you. Because oftentimes, also, these leases are 12-month contracts, right? So you have to be in it for a year, and that takes a lot of commitment. So whether you have a day job to maintain and be able to pay the rent of the studios, like imagine not making money for a couple months. Will you be able to pay your home mortgage or rent as well as the studio's mortgage or rent, right? So it's you have to be able to consider that. Like if shit hits the fan, am I going to be okay? That's the first thing that you should think about. And put yourself in a position where you can't mess up. Are you in a position where you're able to make the studio sound nice and look nice? Does it solve problems? So like after you determine whether or not you want to have a studio, then things like the Google thing. I think going through the exercise, there's a lot of like exercises on Google. You could ask ChatGPT like, what exercises should I do to help find more clients? And maybe ChatGPT will tell you like, go through this form and to build an avatar. And we talked about what it means to have an avatar, like an ideal client. Think about how you're going to market. Take pictures. Hire a photographer. Maybe you have a buddy. Like for us, we lucked out. Like we had a buddy that was trying to start a business doing 360 pictures inside Google, like for Google Maps. And he was like, I just got this camera. I want to start offering this as a service. Can we use you as a guinea pig? So we got 360 images of this inside the studio on Google Maps. And that was done for free for us, but that boosted our listing. That probably made us more money, right? It's hard to determine how much exactly it was without doing the deep dive, but so like these small things do help. Going through an avatar list, talking about like how, like general marketing workshops and like brainstorming activities that you can do. All of these forms are like available online. You could just go through them, watching YouTube videos, how to open a studio, or like how to differentiate yourself, how to build a website, having a website, you know, and making, thinking about customer experience and removing friction and automating as much as you possibly can. This is really important. How are you going to utilize the space and time when you're not there? Is it going to just be for you in your office? Is this, you're going to have someone else on your team? Are you going to need a business partner? Are you going to be moving? Where are you going to live?
Where do you honestly lack versus where your strong suits are? For instance, like when me and DK worked together, DK handled entirely all of our like outreach stuff when it came to online marketing, because that's not my strong suit whatsoever. You know, that's something I never personally dealt with, but DK before us working together was dealing a lot with it. In fact, that's how I found out about him outside of NAMM. When we met at NAMM, that was like an in-person thing. But once I saw his online persona, I knew what type of person DK was because of the way he's moving and posting about things. It wasn't just personal posts. It was like, okay, cool. DK is an engineer. He has a studio. He's working with clients. He's posting content that he makes with the clients. So he's also doing video work with them, this and that. As far as running a studio, if you don't like social media, find somebody who is better at it than you at the very least, or hire somebody for it, because you don't underestimate social media and online presence.
That is the power of the job.
Strategizing the online world is extremely important, because you can, when we opened the studio, because I'm LA native and I built my career in LA, there was no shortage of people who I could reach out to and let them know that I had a studio. So like our first month was pretty booked out. Our second month was great. And DK being new to town, you know, had knew some people, but I don't know if enough to fill the rooms right away. And it's not like we were like so booked that we couldn't take on sessions. It was just, we had enough bookings to make sure that for a long time, we never actually had to pay anything out of pocket. And that was kind of the great thing. If you don't have a network already of people who like booking with you, then it's a huge risk opening it up. And if you can justify that loss in the first couple months, then go ahead and build your network up, start hosting open mics and things of that nature. But the walking in with a network is super necessary. And if you don't have that network, your online presence has to be on point. You have to be posting every day. And it's, if you don't like doing it, you have to get over it.
It's just part of the job.
Yeah.
And this is not one of those Wayne's World, just book them, they will come situations.
Yeah.
You know, just build it, they will come. No, it's not that.
We've seen plenty of celebrities have shows with no ticket sales because marketing didn't do their job.
Yeah. And here's the thing. This is not the episode about how to utilize the internet and social media and stuff, but like, think about this, like one practical advice, everything should be caveman proof. If I go on your website within 5 seconds, within 3 seconds, from 10 feet away from the computer, I should be able to, one, know what you offer, and two, know what you want me to do. There's so many websites where I open it up and I have no idea what the fuck you're offering. Nor do I have any idea what the fuck you want me to do. When I finally find out that the thing that you want me to do is fill out a contact form, which means that there's going to be two extra steps, I don't even do it. I don't want to do it. Now, sometimes you want to build friction. There are cases where you want to build friction on purpose to qualify, you know. Well, we won't get into that right now. But in general, if I go on your social media, the key point is not that I'm doing good work. The key point of Lou said is that looking at my social media immediately, he knew DK was an engineer and DK was serious. That's it. That's the most important. Like, so many of y'all, I have no idea what the fuck you do. I have no idea what you want me to do. You know, it's okay to make silly videos as long as we always know, what is it you want me to do? Like, yeah. What call to action is there? What are you like? What is the point of this video? Oh, he's a mix engineer. It's really easy to identify. That's we could do a website episode another day. These are really, really important things to think about. And it's these small little minor changes that make big results. It's stacking 1% changes all the time. Okay. I think that's kind of it for this episode. Really, there's not much more to talk about. Like, it's a risky thing, and we're not going to be able to cover everything. There's so many different hurdles that you have to think about. And again, we have to generalize from somebody in Nashville to somebody in fucking Pennsylvania. And yeah. It's two different businesses, two different demographics, two different demands as well. Like, the demands in the marketplace. Utah was good because Mormons stereotypically are musical. Like, that's the stereotype of Mormons. They all grow up playing piano because they all have Asian tiger moms. I don't know. And, so it's like the music scene in Utah was vibrant and always active, and that was useful. That may not be the case in Oklahoma. I don't know. And this episode is not how to build your career as an engineer. This episode is about debating whether or not you want to start a studio. And if you do, here's some things to think about. Yeah. If you want to grow your business as an engineer, don't fucking listen to any of this episode, really. Like, throw it all away. I mean, not all of it, but I mean, like, again, I want to be clear on the separation of starting your own studio and the skills and the time that it takes to do that versus being an engineer, which is a totally different set of skills and time management. There is some overlap, but that overlap kind of like starts and ends at taxes. I hope, by the way, tax day is today, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
So everybody, hopefully, by the time, if you haven't filed taxes and you're listening to this episode, it's way too late. Because I'm not releasing this episode today.
Yeah.
So just something to consider. Hopefully everybody's doing well. Yes, we encourage you to, I think hustling, this is something that I need to talk about more often. If hustle culture, like, what is hustling? Like, what does it mean to hustle or to, like, work hard? I'm going to tell you right now, all hustle is, in my definition, that everybody should consider, is accelerated mistake making. That's all it is.
Hell yeah.
Accelerate the amount of mistakes that you make. Go out and try stuff. Fuck up. You can't pay. Like, for me, using FilePass, for example, like, to not get screwed over by clients so they can't run off with my files before paying for them. Like, to make that mistake now costs me so much more money than it did to make that mistake 10 years ago, like 5 years ago. You know what I'm saying? So go ahead and make mistakes early. Make them fast. These small losses that you'll make are only become more expensive to make later. Like, chicken pox will could kill you if you get it when you're older. So get them when you're young, basically. It's kind of like, you know, that's the moral of the story. So on that note, you know, hustle, accelerate your mistake making, fuck up, find out, and have fun while you're doing it. And don't worry about niching right now. That's the last thing. Don't worry about specializing. Don't force a specialty. Don't force a niche. Those niches and specialties will come. At the beginning, say yes to everything. And slowly you're like, I don't want to say yes to everything. And that's how niches come. Don't force it. Okay. I think that's it. Any last minute advice, Lou? Did we cover everything?
We got a lot. I'm sure there's a lot more questions out there in the world. So, you know, people can always shoot them our way. But honestly speaking, if you honestly want that as part of your future, if owning a studio really is something that you see for yourself in the future, just fucking do it. You know, like, just like going to the lottery, not the lottery, the casinos. You set a budget of how much you're willing to lose. Once you lose that amount, you're out, you know. But if you really are dedicated to it and this is something you want, I don't see how you could lose outside of making some pretty stupid mistakes, you know.
Well, like, statistically speaking, most people are going to lose.
Yeah, you're going to lose at some point at the beginning. But if you put proper mindset, if you put proper planning into place, like, you have much better odds of succeeding. You have much better odds of succeeding. The reason we did so well is because we already had a community. We already had a list of clients. We already had our gear. We had everything that we needed. Not just in a physical sense, but in a mental sense and in a business sense to actually make it work from the get-go. Outside of that, we are the exception, not the common experience, you know?
Amen.
Yeah.
All right, dude. Well, thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Again, the two call to actions that we want you to do every single time is, if you haven't already, leave a 5-star review. Helps us a lot. It's free algorithm boosting for us. It does really help us. Like I mentioned, it will help you if you ask your friends to do it. So spread that karma around. Give us some too. Lastly, We have exclusive episodes. We talk about compressors. We talk about limiters. We talk about gates. We talk about different techniques that different engineers use. We get into the nitty-gritty details. We do mix breakdowns where you can listen to the music before and afters. And James asks me what I did, or I asked James what he did, or we ask, we listen to the interviews and we talk about what Jesse did, or Burna Boy did, Baines did, or what Chris Lord Alge did. We talk about different techniques. The more technical stuff, if you want that, go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive to get access to the exclusive episodes of the podcast. Those episodes are ad-free, and they have two episodes every single week. The exclusive archive is once a week, and they're old episodes from a couple years ago. So you unlock all of them if you even just pay for a single month. So it's $4 a month or $40 a year, less than a cup of coffee a week, a month, less than a single cup of coffee a month, and you get access to so much more knowledge that I think will be beneficial to you. So once again, that's mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive. And on that note, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.